Talking History with Patrick Gagan. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch der Orange, Argus.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're looking at the transatlantic mission to the United States of Eamon de Valera in 1919, and we'll be debating whether it was a masterclass in diaspora politics or whether it revealed serious flaws in de Valera's judgment and perhaps even his temperament. You can send us your thoughts and comments to talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. In June 1919, Eamon de Valera slipped out of Ireland and stowed away on a liner bound for New York. When he arrived, he walked into the Waldorf Astoria Hotel and signed the guestbook as President of Ireland. For the next 18 months, he made one of the most luxurious hotels in the world his headquarters as the War of Independence raged at home. From that base, he crisscrossed the United States, addressing vast crowds and raising more than $5 million for the Republican cause as he spoke to audiences totaling well over a million people. America was more than a fundraising tour. It was also a harsh political education. In the cut and thrust of American party politics, de Valera learned lessons about power, leadership and control that would define his later dominance of Irish politics. And so to discuss and debate this visit, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Professor Bernadette Whelan is Professor Emeritus in the School of History and Geography at the University of Limerick and is a leading historian of Irish-American diplomacy. Her award-winning book, De Valera and Roosevelt, explored transatlantic relations during the 1930s. She's co-editor of Documents on Irish Foreign Policy, Volume 14 and Volume 15 will be published at the end of the year, and she's currently completing a biography of Sinead De Valera. Professor Colm Kenny is Professor Emeritus at DCU and is a distinguished historian, barrister and journalist. His books include Dangerous Ambition, a critical re-examination of de Valera's early career, as well as studies of Arthur Griffith and the Anglo-Irish Treaty. Professor Eunan O'Halpin is Fellow Emeritus at Trinity College Dublin and the inaugural holder of the Bank of Ireland Chair of Contemporary Irish History there. He's written widely on the Revolutionary Era, Intelligence and Anglo-Irish Relations, and his books include studies of Kevin Barry and The Dead of the Irish Revolution, which he co-authored. Well, you're all very welcome. And Bernadette, I might begin with you, and I might begin with a question about why de Valera went to America in 1919 and what was he hoping to achieve?
Thanks very much, Patrick. I think the story really of de Valera's career and his 18-month American mission between 1919 and 1920, there's an awful lot known about that. But I think in term there's, and generally writers, they focus on two aspects of the trip. In other words, two of his goals. The writers generally focus on the unsuccessful efforts to obtain diplomatic recognition for the Republic from the US government, and then, of course, the calamitous split in Irish America. And he's shared part blame, indeed, for these two disasters. But his mission was also successful in one respect, which was raising money for the Dáil Éireann government. So for him, his key aims, and really he was thinking about this well before he actually left. I mean, when he's even in Lincoln Prison, he's awfully excited, as are most Irish nationalists, about how Wilson's principle of self-determination could apply to the Irish case for independence. So the goals that he had were A, to achieve recognition, diplomatic recognition, B, to bring Irish America behind him, C, to raise as much money as he could, and to launch what was in effect a propaganda campaign.
And Bernadette, there's a fascinating presidential election taking place in America in 1920, and you have Franklin Delano Roosevelt on the ticket for the Democratic Party as the vice presidential candidate, and you have Warren Harding running for the Republicans with an America First slogan. And it's very interesting the way the visit feeds into that election campaign as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Not least because where you can see the split in Irish America, which you can argue was never a monolith anyway, the split in Irish America is really very obvious from then onwards. And in effect, it is, as David McCullough has talked about, De Valera commits a known goal the way he involves himself in the presidential conventions, the Republican one first and then the second one in San Francisco later on. But I think that's the culmination, that's summer 1920, of a lot of division and tension that had gone before it. And a lot of it is largely focused on the money side of things.
On the money side, and we'll tease that out as well. Colm, there's a very interesting story about when De Valera returns and he asks what's happening since he's been gone. But whether true or not, it gives a nice kind of insight into perhaps some of the political preoccupations and considerations.
Oh, it's very colourful. He comes back after this lengthy trip to the United States. I mean, he's gone for more than half of the Board of Independence, basically, for 18 months. And he comes in on the boat and he's met by Tom Cullen and possibly Bat O'Connor at Dublin. And he says, "How are things, guys?" Even before he's got off the boat, apparently. And Tom Cullen says to him, "Oh, the big fella's leading us and things are going marvellous." And De Valera stops and he slaps his hand on the handrail and he says, "Big fella, we'll see who's the big fella." And this kind of, you know, brings back the tensions that existed on the Irish side at that stage, particularly between De Valera and Collins. Now, whether it's true or not is a good question, because it's told, for instance, by Tim Pat Coogan, and it appears to be a case of a man told him that a man told him that a man told him that Bat O'Connor, who might have been there, told him. And an awful lot of what we know about this period of turmoil in Ireland depends on these kind of anecdotal stories, apocryphal stories, or on things said much later, maybe to the Bureau of Military History. And I think it's sobering to remember that, even though many of these stories are very colourful, it's very important that we depend on the original sources again and again and acknowledge the fact that, to a frustrating extent, we can't be sure of exactly what happened.
Colm, that's an excellent point about the sources. And I think the anecdote also captures the point you made about De Valera being absent from Ireland for a large part of the War of Independence. What does that actually mean in terms of him being disconnected from what's happening back home?
He was very much disconnected. It's understood that he wanted, actually, when he was sprung from jail by Collins and Boland from Lincoln prison, he wanted to go to America straight away, and he was prevailed on to come back to Dublin, where he was made president of the Dáil only in April 1919. And then he's gone 2 months later and Arthur Griffith becomes president, and in fact remains. Arthur Griffith was president of the Dáil in practice longer than De Valera was before the Civil War. And he's out of touch. He wasn't a great politician, though, in the first place, De Valera. He hadn't been involved in Sinn Féin to any extent until after 1916. Politics, he wasn't interested until he was in his 30s. He was following a professional career. He wanted to be a professor of mathematics. And he was waltzed into his seat, of course, in County Clare, basically, by the organisation, and didn't have to do anything resembling modern politics. He always saw himself in a more symbolic way. He called himself a monument to the brave dead after 1916 as one of the senior commandants to survive. And later he would call himself the symbol of the revolution. And I think De Valera was much more akin to a royal monarch than he was to a politician. And that's possibly one of the reasons why he got so exercised in the end during the rows about the treaty over the status of the king. That was the big thing for De Valera. So when he goes to America, he's not bringing much real political experience with him. And this may help to explain some of the things you've already mentioned, some of the tensions and some of the potential failures and missteps that he made while he was in the United States.
And it's interesting what you say about maybe at this stage he's not a politician. As we know, he goes on to become a very, very wily politician and many decades of political involvement. I wonder, do you think he picks up something, it's almost like an education for him over in the United States, where he is hanging out with all of these politicians from different parties, he is at the Democratic and Republican conventions, and I wonder, is this maybe something of a training ground for him as well?
Yes, he did make a comment in the Dáil during the Treaty of Bates about knowing nothing about politics until this. He certainly learned the hard way. And he was, you know, to use Dunphy's expression, a man of two halves. He was a different De Valera later, I think, to the De Valera that we see up until the foundation of Fianna Fáil.
Eunan, let's talk about his time in America. The fact that he stays at the Waldorf Astoria, which seems to have been hugely expensive, the way he signs the guest book as President of Ireland, and the way he engages in this remarkable tour across the United States, giving speeches, involved in various negotiations and discussions. It is quite a remarkable period that he's there.
Well, it is remarkable, and in some ways, there is quite a lot of public deference to him, not only within Irish America, which he's trying to capture, because also it is a moment where not only Ireland is looking for independence and looks to Wilson and to his 14 points, but also to the emerging League of Nations, ironically, as being a possible route forward. And also the very concept legitimizes the idea of national self-determination. There's also lots of other nationalities in the United States who are equally, if not revered equally, but certainly are also think that the United States and the Wilson administration may help them get independence, including, inconveniently, nationalities within the British Empire, which is always a problem. For example, the Egyptians, the Indians, who had conspired in America with Germany during the First World War, as indeed had the Irish. And I think it's a mistake to think that, certainly within the American policy system, that there weren't people who remembered the Irish-German link, if you like, not only in the military and the limited security services, but also within the State Department, and who were not that well disposed at all to Irish rebels, however much in theory they endorsed the Wilsonian concept of national self-determination.
And Eunan, are people taking him seriously over there?
It's clear, particularly from Bernadette's book, because Bernadette, unlike many other historians, including myself, has gone so thoroughly through American records rather than on very limited and problematic Irish ones. It's clear that Ireland is a problem for Wilson politically, especially in terms of trying to get America over the line to support the League of Nations, because so many of those who vociferously support De Valera and Irish independence, at least in an undefined way, are also hugely influential or attempt to be in developing American isolationism, which also ultimately results in the American Senate rejecting the League of Nations. And so you're making, inadvertently perhaps, but you're making an enemy of the American president, because he's the one, above all, who's identified with the policy of the 14 points, yes, but also of the League of Nations. And can you have one without the other?
And there is some incredible iconography from the trip as well. I'm thinking of the photograph of De Valera being made a Native American chief, and the outfit, and it's the cover of Dave Hannigan's excellent book on De Valera in America. It's in Dermot Ferriter's book, and it's one of those very striking images. It's in columns as well. Like, it's a very striking image.
But you would wonder about his political judgment in allowing that photograph to be taken, because the idea that First Nations, as they would be known now, that these were, that their case was somehow popular right across American politics, is of course absolutely ludicrous. The very idea that the indigenous peoples of North America had been wrongly treated under British colonialism and later under the United States would have been anathema, as much in the Democratic as in the Republican Party and right across the political spectrum.
It was very much a personal thing with him, this. It was very curious. I totally agree. I mean, it was this very strange, one would say principled in some way, decision, but it was actually a very personal decision. And it brings us back to De Valera's days in Brewery, when he was sent to Ireland by his mother to be brought up by an uncle and his granny, who then died. And he was out on the hills minding cattle, reading. And he was to tell the OGB Indians, when he met them in Wisconsin for the ceremony where he was made a Native chief, he was to tell them that he had dreamt of becoming a Native American one day. They were his words. And he was very happy to be there. And of course, he addressed them in Irish, which must have puzzled them a little bit. But there was a massive ceremony out on the plain, and he narrowly avoided having to become a blood brother by bleeding. But he said he was very proud to be there, and it seemed to be some kind of a political point. He would return to it again. He sent them rifles as a gift afterwards, which must have gone down not very well indeed in Washington. But there you had it. And he insisted to Harry Boland, who was with him on that trip, that he was now a real, not an honorary, but a real American chieftain. So there was something going on again in his head about symbols.
And he always liked a feather in his cap.
He did indeed. And Colin, while he was there, he also met his mother in New York.
Well, this was part of the thing, that his mother had sent him home at the age of 2.5. she was unable to cope. I mean, whoever his father was, and we're not sure about that, had disappeared or died about the age of two. So she sent him back to this labourer's cottage, and he could never wait to get away from it. And indeed, he had a remarkably successful struggle to get education for any child in those circumstances, getting into Blackrock College, getting through the National University, and even registering at Trinity for a further degree. He was an extraordinary individual, pulled himself up by the bootstraps. But his mother had sent him back and only visited twice. Once when she came to say she was about to marry an Englishman in America, by whom she had two further children. And on one other occasion when she came back with his half-brother, who later became a priest when he was in Black Rock. So they weren't well known to one another on a personal level. And the child, Eddie, or Eamon as he later became, was asking to go back to America quite a lot and really wanted to return, but she never took him. So this was quite a formidable meeting when they arranged to go up to see her. And there's a photograph of the two of them meeting, and it's not a very happy-looking photograph. They're unsmiling and standing separately. But he made sure he met her, and he would go on to have quite a good relationship with his half-brother, who was eventually killed in a car crash. But that was a curious side of the affair. At that stage, though, by 1919, 1920, he was grateful to his mother and brother for having lent themselves to the campaign in 1916 to have him not executed and to have his sentence of penal servitude reduced. Of course, it wasn't a successful campaign particularly, but it raised his profile in Washington, or in fact, it created something of a profile in Washington. So, you know, there was an uneasy relationship partly based, I think, on how he looked to people in relation to his relationship with his mother and how useful his mother might be in terms of his status within the United States.
Bernadette, while he's over there, he makes a major statement on Cuba, or comparing Cuba's relationship with the United States with a possible future relationship between Britain and Ireland. And can you tell us about that statement and how that was received?
Yeah, if I could just make one point before that, Patrick, just on there's often a lot of criticism shipped his way around staying in the Waldorf Astoria. Just to make clear that from when he arrived and he met with Joe McGarrity, who largely funded a lot of his activities, McGarrity is the one who insisted that he bought him suits, he bought him new luggage, he insisted that he stay in the hotel, he insisted that he amend the title that he went over, which was President of the Ministry of Dáil Éireann, and it's amended down to the President of the Irish Republic, to try and increase that kind of sense of legitimacy that a new republic would have and that he would be able to give it. So there is that awareness from the beginning. And De Valera himself says that he's called President of the Republic the first time over there, and it's frequently used. And indeed, when Sinead arrives, she's regarded as the First Lady. And it is within the context of a new state, but obviously linking it into what is the case in American politics as well. So that's just one point. The other point, which is, and it links into what you're saying, what you asked me to talk about there in relation to the Cuban analogy. Eunan mentioned the pro-Germanism, and this was, and he's quite right in the sense of it was still so strong within the American political and within American public opinion. And De Valera, among the mistakes that he made, was one to refer quite frequently, that Ireland might have been better off under the Tsar, the Kaiser, and that's taken up by his opponents as a touch of pro-Germanism. And there's a lot of opposition to him on that basis. Indeed, among the opponents that he encounters at some of his rallies were the American Legion, those war vets. So that was kind of one mistaken understanding that he had of the American political system. The second then was this, he didn't give an interview. He was asked for an interview. He didn't give it. Instead, he gave his notes to a journalist. And the New York Globe, picked up by the Westminster Gazette, ran with this supposed quote from him. And he suggested four proposals as to how British security would not be affected if Ireland was given independence. So that was his main point. And among the proposals he made an analogy between Britain and Ireland and America and Cuba, referring to the Platt Amendment. that was really, again, another own goal, to use the phrase I used earlier, largely because most Americans knew that America had intervened and continued to interfere in Cuban supposed independence as often and whenever they wanted to. So it wasn't terribly reassuring to his supporters, be they Americans or Irish Americans, that he was not entirely supportive of a full break with London. So while on the one hand he thought he was coming out and suggesting that Ireland would pursue a position of neutrality in relation to British security, which is interesting for later developments, but instead it's taken up as De Valera is happy to have British interference in Irish affairs, you know, whenever, as long as some form of independence is given. So that was another blunder, and that happened in early 1920. So if you add in the kind of pro-Germanism, which, as Eunan said, continues to be very prevalent within the State Department, and indeed within, we have Bureau of Investigation reports and files that are continuously following De Valera, and he's included under one of those categories of radicals, which the American Bureau of Investigation, later the FBI, continue to trail him, as do some British agents. So he's seen in so many circles still as, you know, not fully supportive of American patriotism and the American side and the Allied side. That combined with this sense of Germanism, the reference then in the Westminster Gazette, and then the mistake of that he makes with the presidential conventions. Really, you know, the support base behind him, instead of uniting it, which was one of his goals, it's splintering.
Eunan, although there were problems with the Cuba analogy, was there a kind of a vision or a brilliance behind it as well, in that it was also sending maybe a reassuring message to Britain?
As Burdett has said, it's not clear that he was going to say it. It was in his notes. But having said that, yes, whether he intended to say it then or not, and he does row back from it a bit in public, it does, I think, at least indicate some of his thinking, which over time develops. He wasn't the only member, obviously, of the revolutionary elite to begin to think about these problems. Later on, Erskine Childers, for example, influences him a lot and educates him a lot, you could argue, in terms of the British sort of imperial perspective, in terms of their strategic defence, need to defend the seas around Ireland and so on. But certainly I take it, and others take it, as an important signal that he is beginning to think in some ways more realistically about geopolitics of the relationship with Britain than most of the sort of revolutionary rhetoric and nationalist rhetoric at the time indicates more generally.
Bernadette, you mentioned that Sinead, De Valera's wife, visited him in the United States, and I know you're writing a biography on Sinead De Valera. What was life like for her in Ireland before she came over? And then, in terms of the visit, how did that come about?
Yeah, prior to and to her departure for the United States, life had been, obviously, since 1916, since his arrest. I mean, he had spent most of his time in prison whenever he was out. There was work to be done, and he was away from home. Meanwhile, the size of her family increased, and there were these constant house moves. As we know, they didn't own their own house until well into the 1940s. So for her, life was quite difficult and traumatic. She had a lot of support, it can be said, at the same time, from her own family, though often money was very, very scarce, and you can see that from Jerry De Valera's biography, where there's references to it, even though he was only born from 1922 honours, but Maureen De Valera, the daughter, also referenced tightness in terms of finances. And in that context, one of the people who does visit her and who does support her, particularly after De Valera goes to America, is Michael Collins. And he comes out and visits her. She's at this stage living in Craiglee in Greystones, which is most unusual location, given that it was a Protestant Unionist stronghold in terms of concentration, a demographic concentration at the time. But she does settle in there. Her children go to the Holy Faith Convent and eventually would go into school in Westland Row using the train. Vivian does, and other boys follow. But so her life is difficult. Of course, then after he's released from jail and then he escapes from Lincoln, she has constant surveillance. There are raids on the house. She's constant. But she always said that when he was in prison and then when he was in the States, even though he was away. She felt much more content because she knew where he was and she knew he wasn't going to be arrested. And that was one of her worries the whole time, if he was to be not just arrested, I should say, but that he wouldn't be, he might not be put to death or given a death sentence for any of his activities. So she had a little bit of comfort from that. The visit itself comes from a visit. Boland came home in May, June 1919. He visits her with Michael Collins and he convinces her to go. Now, the narrative around her trip is often seen as she used the words to herself a mistake. But in fact, when you looked at it a little bit more closely and you look at her actual other words and letters she wrote to people and her own memories of it. The visit was supposed to be 3 months. It only was six weeks. And in fact, that I think is what she saw as the mistake. And from when Boland convinced her to go, that De Valera is not in good shape. And that was the case. He was exhausted after various tours. But also they had been talking about it in correspondence from when he had left in 1919, and this is 1920. I may have said 1919 in relation to Boland coming home. It's 1920. So they had been talking about it. They missed each other. They wanted to see each other. He says it's a mistake. She didn't go out. So she has all that in her mind. She also has her reliable sister, B, to take over the house, and she moved in with her husband, Dick Cotter. And So that's when she heads off. Now, she's very worried about the whole thing because there is surveillance. She's got to get a passport. The passport has incorrect details around her, which Collins provides. And they eventually get over there. And when she's over there, there is a reunion. No, he's not in the harbour waiting for her to arrive. There's all this debate about whether he knew she was coming or not. He had been contacted by Boland and by Collins to say that she was arriving. So he didn't know that she was coming, just not the details when. So, and the visit then, as it transpires, it's a time when she starts writing and she has Kathleen O'Connell type up a short story for herself. It's often assumed that she doesn't start writing until after Brian's death in 1934. She starts writing before that. She speaks publicly and she's acknowledged as a first lady. She doesn't like having to give interviews, but she gives interviews, but it's only to people she wants to give interviews for. And she writes a wonderful article comparing summer schools in Ireland with a summer school she had attended, a Catholic summer school in upstate New York. So for her, the visit had very mixed, very mixed experiences. And the narrative around it is largely one that she created herself subsequently, that she had made the mistake. But I think when you look more closely at it, she did enjoy herself there. She went out and visited people. She made new friends with the Hearns. The O'Maras were there, who were good friends of the family. And Patricia Lavelle writes about her and how they enjoy their time there. So I think there's more to be said about Sinead's time there, but at the same time, she's happy to get home.
The same time, she's happy to come home. Colm?
Well, I'm very glad that somebody's writing a biography of Sinead, because I did devote a section of my book on De Valera to her, and I talked about the importance of her and of his mother in making De Valera. But I take some convincing to believe that when she said it had been a mistake, the trip was actually a success. De Valera didn't treat her very well. I mean, it was just a reflection of the status of women at the time, but there's very little to suggest he got her permission or consent when he left her and the children in the lurch and went out in 1916. She lost her house. They lost their maid, who had to be laid off. Sinead's mother was extremely ill. Her sister was ill. They were penniless. And then there's this curious transformation, perhaps with the backing of American money, when she finds herself comfortably housed in what's a very nice mansion in the Burnaby in Greystone, still one of the most exclusive places to live, quite far from Dublin, 45 kilometres. She wasn't raided any more than other people were. But she's also visited there by Griffith. Griffith was quite supportive of De Valera in this period. He's not critical of De Valera over Cuba. He brushes it aside. In fact, of course, he's trying to educate De Valera and others to some extent in his view that if we're going to have a united Ireland that's independent, we have to have some kind of facilitation. And he was also, I think, Sinead De Valera is quite grateful to Griffith. She had a hard life. And she was an extraordinary woman in her own right, an actor, who'd been offered a job by William Fay in the Abbey Theatre, who'd been praised by Yeats for her amateur acting, who had taken an initiative in setting up Irish language courses, and who had much more interest in Irish culture before De Valera had, before he threw his lot in with the volunteers. So I welcome the book, but I do hope that it maintains a critical perspective. As for Joe, the devil making De Valera stay in the Waldorf Hotel, Joe McGarrity prevailing on him. He must have been easier to prevail upon in those days than when he refused to go to London for the treaty talks, when they were all trying to prevail on him in the end to go over and join them.
Bernadette, we're going to go to a break, but is Colin being too harsh on Dev?
Well, I think he's been too harsh on Sinead to start with. I think he completely underestimates the depth of her political beliefs and her own patriotism and her willingness to support her husband and the Irish national cause in any way she could.
Brilliant. We're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll be finding out about that calamitous split in Irish America. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we are talking about Eamon de Valera's visit to the United States during the War of Independence. My brilliant panel of experts, Professor Bernadette Whelan is Professor Emeritus in the School of History and Geography at the University of Limerick and is a leading historian of Irish-American diplomacy. Her award-winning book, De Valera and Roosevelt, explored transatlantic relations during the 1930s. She's the co-editor of Documents on Irish Foreign Policy, Volume 14, and Volume 15 will be published at the end of the year. She's a member of the Royal Irish Academy and is currently completing a biography of Sinead de Valera. Professor Colm Kenny is Professor Emeritus at DCU and is a distinguished historian, barrister and journalist. His books include Dangerous Ambition, A Critical Re-examination of de Valera's Early Career, A Study of Arthur Griffith and A New Look at the Anglo-Irish Treaty. And he sees Eamon de Valera as a key to understanding contemporary Irish affairs, and he's done so much to re-evaluate this period of Irish history. Professor Eunan O'Halpin is Fellow Emeritus at Trinity College Dublin and former holder of the Bank of Ireland Chair of Contemporary Irish History. He has written widely on the Revolutionary Era, Intelligence and Anglo-Irish Relations, and his books include A Study of Kevin Barry, and he's the co-author of The Dead of the Irish Revolution. Well, Eunan, let's talk about the diaspora, because that's such an important part of this visit. And what you really see is De Valera engaging in that world of diaspora politics.
Yeah, he does engage in diaspora politics disastrously, but without getting into that too much, there's more Irish Americans in America than we think of when we think of the Irish diaspora. And it's very important to realise this, that it has continued to be a public illusion into the 21st century that Irish America, that the people of Irish origin in America are automatically signed up for the Green Harps and signed up for whatever Dublin asks them to do. And linked to that, there is the problem that the diasporas typically, speaking activist diasporas, are also typically anxious to demonstrate their patriotism and their attachment to the new world of which they have become part, and to the new polity. So you have potentially a contradiction there, because on the one hand, they are characteristically showing we are loyal Americans above all, but we are also loyal to the old country. And there can be, certainly in policy terms, as we see, there is a disjuncture between those two sort of general sentiments. The other point I'd make about the Irish diaspora is it was seen, as Bernard has mentioned, it's also a source not only of political support, however you define the diaspora, but also financial support for the Irish Revolution and for the revolutionary government and so on. And there, undoubtedly, De Valera is very successful, you know, in political panhandling, if you like, and also in building up a consciousness within segments of Irish America in relation to the Irish cause in a very general way rather than in a specific way. And money does matter. But I think we see it in later iterations. In 1922, my granny, Kathy Barry, went with Countess Markovitch to America to pass around the hat for the anti-Republican side, the split which becomes the Civil War. And successive generations of Republicans have constantly tried to work the Irish-American beat for financial support and so on. In some ways, not everybody is putting money in the hat, and not everybody who identifies themselves as Irish-American, and not even everybody of importance who are sympathetic to the idea of Irish self-determination buy into the version of it that De Valera is promoting. But because of the financial end, especially, which in terms of Irish politics is really important, I think in some ways it is sometimes overstressed. The money is important, but it doesn't equal commensurate political weight in domestic United States, and sometimes it complicates relations with the American administration, which has a much bigger set of strategic interests than Irish self-determination.
Bernadette, in part one, you referred to it as the calamitous split in Irish America. And I wonder, why is there a split, and how much of it is down to the strong personalities of those involved, and could it have been avoided, and how damaging was it?
If I could just mention one thing, I think Eunan is there perfectly right about this thing of, I've always asked myself, how powerful was the Irish vote in American elections, and which part of the Irish vote, you know, votes for which party? I mean, the Republican convention and the Democratic convention that we were just talking about there, in both cases, they failed to introduce any kind of a plank on their platforms for the campaign, as it would evolve, the presidential campaign, that was recognition, providing diplomatic recognition for the Irish Republic. But what they did do was express, at least the Democrat one, admiration for other recently established representative governments in Czechoslovakia, in Yugoslavia and Poland. So, you know, I think we do have to be very careful about when we're weighing up the extent of the Irish influence in American politics from the very beginning. In terms of the split, I think it's really interesting that Eunan has referred there to his grandmother, because we know from early visitors to the United States about the evidence that there were difficulties within the relationships. I mean, Maud Gonne talked about the warring factions that she encountered when she was in the United States, and particularly the personality of John Bavoy, who was very much America first and became increasingly so. Hanashihi Skeffington also noted the divisions within Irish America. And it is because, as mentioned at the very beginning, Irish America is not a monolith. Irish America, in geographical terms, in terms of class, in terms of religion, as we know, status, all these things, they all influenced people to have different views of particularly the Irish issue. And for most of them, as we saw during World War I, and particularly after 1916, America comes first. And indeed, even they re-elect Wilson in 1916 in that election, even though he had not come out with any blatant support for the 1916 dead. And then even the statement that he issued, which is a very mealy-mouthed one, when Casement is about to be executed, and which somehow or other gets lost in diplomatic post between DC and London, and it being presented to Whitehall. Despite those two omissions, one could call from an Irish-American perspective, a nationalist perspective, they still vote for him. So, you know, Irish America is very difficult to define. And I think that's part of the difficulties that De Valera would now encounter. Boland had also identified these major differences. So you have, on the one hand, McGarrity and De Valera, as it would transpire. And then on the other hand, you had Judge Cohalan from New York, and John Devoy, who's the editor of the Gaelic American, who was a fierce opponent of Woodrow Wilson's from a very early stage. So they initially, you know, it's quite interesting, before De Valera is even unveiled in New York, after he's arrived, smuggled into the States, who does he go off and meet? He goes off and meets Senator Borah, who's the chief Republican on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and leading the opposition to the League of Nations, America entering the League of Nations or even being part of it. He meets with Cardinal Gibbons of Baltimore, and he obviously meets with McGarrity. So, you know, one would have thought that his priorities might have been to meet with Democrats, but that doesn't happen until later. So, leading Democrats, it should be said. So those difficulties and differences, and they quickly emerge really around the whole fundraising thing. The Friends of Irish Freedom, which was the Clonagel IRB kind of front organisation, it had raised from January 1919 what they called the Irish Victory Fund. And they had raised in that $1 million, which would turn out to be in today's terms about $12 million. That had been used to fund De Valera's hospitality and his stay over there in the tours. It was used to buy what would then eventually be the bond certificates. And this was the plan that De Valera and others, it has to be said, particularly John Ryan, who was the American commissioner, one of the American commissioners for Irish independence, sent from the Friends of Irish Freedom to Paris. And then they come to Dublin for a bit. He advised him to go to America and if they needed money to run the Doyle and the government, which this is part of the reason, as we said earlier, why they did. So the Friends of Irish Freedom and the Irish Victory Fund, De Valera had first of all to close that down, which happened by August 1919. And the bit of the Victory Fund that's left over went into, and they bought about $10,000 worth of what De Valera called the bond certificates. A term that he actually got from Franklin Delano Roosevelt with his legal hat on. So the differences would come over the fundraising, how it was organised, and then, of course, what it would be spent on and who had control over it. And that they were the big issues that would split Irish America eventually.
So, Colm, you do see that despite some success and some aspects of the visit, there are also then these elements where De Valera perhaps isn't quite getting it right in terms of the nuances and in terms of, you know, trying to avoid complications and difficulties and ensure that it's a smooth visit. So there are these tensions, there are these issues, and there are these fights and conflicts.
In fairness to him, it's hard to see what member of the government would have done better than he had in ways. I mean, they had to learn, I think, you know, it's been pointed out by Eunan already, I mean, the complexity of Irish America, which is to this day often missed here. We get a view of the United States very often in media in Ireland through the prism of New York Democratic Party politics. And I think it's a very important point to remember these complexities, even to understand, we were talking about Cuba earlier, that whole beginning of American imperialism when they took Cuba, Puerto Rico. And so it's still to this day, we can see with Trump's carry on in relation to Venezuela and Cuba, that there are aspects to American foreign policy that we perhaps don't fully understand on this side of the Atlantic when we look at it too simplistically. Who would have done better? It's a good parlor game, but he did possibly the best he could. And in fairness, these big crowds that met him adoringly and cheered him on, well, they may well have gone to his head and encouraged this notion that he was going to be king of Ireland somehow. They would have had some impact on American politics. There was some leverage there, but whether he could have ever avoided a split is difficult to say.
Yeah, Eunan, that is one point to bear in mind. There are these huge crowds at Fenway Park, and I think there's a speech in Madison Square Garden that, you know, he is attracting the crowds. There is a significant impact in terms of those big public events.
I think there probably are, and you don't have to be a rock star to like acclamation. I do think, though, that one of the points about Dev and America, which is quite different than Dev and Britain, it is when he gets into power, he continues, it seems to me, to misread America and to read it through much through a kind of green Irish-American prism. He sends Robert Brennan there to be the Irish, if you like, the Irish ambassador. Brennan has been a journalist and so on, but he's entirely locked into a version of Irish America himself rather than trying to work the policy system. I mean, this comes out, amongst other things, one of Bernadette's other books, that I don't know if she agrees with me, but he continues to look at America. Perhaps he has to play this card without fully believing it, as though America isn't a serious geopolitical actor, whereas he very quickly, certainly from 1932, takes Britain to be a very serious geopolitical actor.
Well, we are talking history and we are talking about De Valera's visit to the United States for that 18-month tour in 1919 to 1920. We're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, we'll be exploring the legacy of the visit. Welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we are talking about de Valera's visit to the United States during the War of Independence. Our brilliant panel of experts, Professor Bernadette Whelan, Professor Emeritus at the University of Limerick, Professor Colm Kenny is Professor Emeritus at DCU, and Professor Eunan O'Halpin, Fellow Emeritus at Trinity College Dublin. Bernadette, I wonder, do you agree with Eunan's take on those dimensions of the visit in terms of the speeches and the impact and indeed these wider consequences?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the first point to make about the kind of adulation, one of the problems that he identified himself very early on in the tours is that if he had a dollar for every handshake, there'd be no need for the official fundraising activities. And it was very clear very early on that he was placed at the centre of it and that he himself realised that pretty soon on. So there is that kind of adulation that he receives, which you could say went to his head. On the other hand, you could say he realized was going to be an advantage in terms of the fundraising. And he was linking both clearly very, very early on. Just to come back to the point about the legacy. There's a very interesting little piece written a long time ago now by Owen Dudley Edwards on de Valera in 1987. And later, Robert Schmuel would agree with him that, and they argued that de Valera held what they called a mythical-like view of the United States. And I think, and specifically then of Irish Americans. And they reckon that that is what accounted for his constant optimistic hopes. And this is what one of the legacies, perhaps, of the trip for him, that he was constantly optimistic and hopeful that Irish Americans, Americans, almost every US government would be anxious to assist Ireland in every way in times of crisis. And even though evidence would be presented to the contrary, and that indeed his own experience revealed differently from the time he was there, particularly the presidential conventions, it doesn't seem to have kind of cut through this belief that he had. And it seems that it is from, you know, relating to that it was the place of his birth, that his mother's homeland, that he kind of saw it as always a source of political, financial, moral assistance throughout his life, irrespective, as I say, what the reality was.
Colm, Bernadette mentioned this kind of maybe mythical view and perspective there. He also seems to have kind of had a mythical view of unionists in Northern Ireland, and a belief that, or what became Northern Ireland at this time, that he had a belief that once Britain was removed from the equation, they would be quite happily to be part of a republic. And he seems to be really disconnected with the reality on the islands of Ireland.
Well, that's a popular view, but I think it's an interesting point that Eunan made early was that perhaps he was already formulating in his own mind an acceptance of political realities where you had to make allowances. And when he gets back, I mean, he's given pretty much free rein. He's not in jail when there's much made of it, a moment when he's arrested almost by mistake early that year, but he's released within 24 hours because the British actually intervene in the government to get him out of jail. He goes off to talk to Lloyd George as soon as the truce is declared, and he has these conversations with Lloyd George on his own, much will be made later of Griffith and Collins meeting people in London during the treaty talks on their own, but he had set the precedent and he knew what the score was. And he stands up and makes this remarkable speech in Dáil Éireann in August 1921 before the treaty talks begin. And it's not noticed enough. I think John Bowman was one of the first people to make much of it in his book on de Valera and the Ulster question, but it keeps fading into the fog. And in that speech, he recognises that any Ulster county that wishes will have the right to vote itself out of a Irish Republic. Now, it's hard to get, people don't grasp this. I mean, later so much is made about the Boundary Commission, the so-called acceptance of partition, which the treaty people didn't accept in reality, but they were forced to acknowledge. But de Valera told the Dáil on that day, the 22nd of August 1921, if the Republic were recognised, he'd be in favour of giving each county power to vote itself out of the Republic if it so wished. Otherwise, they'd be compelled to use force. And he said they hadn't the power, and some of them had not the inclination to use force with Ulster. He didn't think that policy would be successful. They'd be making the same mistake with that section as England had made with Ireland, and he would not be responsible for such a policy. And more in the same vein. And Bowman points out that his speech stunned the Dáil. It was met with dissatisfaction, apprehension and confusion. And I think we've kind of almost suppressed the reality of that statement by De Valera, because if you recognise what he said that day, and it was one of these private sessions of the Doyles, so the records didn't, they got locked away for decades afterwards. But if you look at what he says there, it opens up a whole new way of interpreting his later behaviour in relation to what happens during the treaty talks in London. So he's a complex individual. He's struggling in his own way to find ways to balance and, balance things, that bring them together, you know, play with them in his own head. All the time, I think he's doing his best in his own way, but there is ultimately an irreconcilable conflict. And in the end, he's forced to choose, and we know how he chose in the end.
Eunan, we've had a wonderful discussion of De Valera's visit to the United States, but I'm still not certain or clear in my own mind about whether this was a successful visit for the Irish cause, whether it was one that had mixed results, whether we see De Valera emerging as a statesman and leader, or whether he's someone who's, you know, getting into unnecessary conflicts and scrapes and bad decisions. So how do we assess it, and, you know, what grade are we giving him for this visit?
It's like marking a student essay. Different examiners may take very different views, but in universities you have to reconcile your marks at some point, whereas historians don't. I think we have to look at the domestic side of it. As Colm has pointed out, it was left to Griffith and Collins and those in Dublin to manage matters, as it were, as the war hotted up, as the war took directions, which some of them, including probably Dev, didn't particularly like. And yet, so he was away for whatever, 17, 18 months. He comes back and he insists on taking control again himself, very directly, perhaps without acknowledging how much the others have done and how much the others have achieved. And so the question of his absence is as important in terms of the American trip, I think, as what he achieved over there. And clearly what he did achieve over there with a segment of the Irish diaspora was to mobilise resources and develop what I think is more a myth than a reality of the unity of Irish America and of its power to influence American administrations, which demonstrably it was unable to do. In respect of Ireland in 1919 and 1920, but ironically contributed to the thwarting of the great policy of the American administration, of the Wilson administration, which was the League of Nations and so on. So I think diplomatically, we have to, in the long term diplomatically, it was certainly not successful. Yes, in terms of, if you like, perpetuating, developing a myth of the power of Irish America, but that's largely in terms of public festivals, if you like, and of raising money rather than of long-term policy.
Bernadette, I'm going to leave the final word to you. How would you assess the visit and its impact?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's that balance sheet to be reckoned. Recognition of the Republic was as far away as ever, and it never occurred until the Free State was in place, when then there's the diplomatic recognition of the Free State eventually. As Eunan said, Irish America, if it was ever united, it splintered even more. $5 million was raised, equivalent of about $75 million today, but most of it didn't return to Ireland. He did give a higher prominence, I think, on the other hand, to the issue of Irish independence, which you could say played a role in terms of ending the War of Independence and movement towards the truce, but it's a very, very tenuous role when you look at British cabinet minutes. And so the effect on De Valera then, I think, is that he was lionized. Their political opposition to him does emerge quite strongly, but it then does at the same time formulate this view in him about Irish America and about its actual role within and power within US administrations and ultimately in Anglo-Irish relations.
Well, that does bring us to the end of a wonderful discussion on De Valera's visit to the United States. My thanks to my brilliant panel of experts, Professor Bernadette Whelan, Professor Emeritus at the University of Limerick, Professor Colm Kenny, Professor Emeritus at DCU, and Professor Eunan O'Halpin, Fellow Emeritus at Trinity College Dublin. Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Mairéad O'Sullivan, for bringing everything together. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so hope you can join us then. We've been talking history. Good night.